Let me quickly summarize. One is labeled the Stakeholder Group Initial Recommendations Summary, Revision 5. I'll just spend a minute on this just to recount that, as you recall in some of my previous testimony and updates on the stakeholders group, that we were given a revenue target for the Oregon Health Plan of $933 million. This represents actually a 10% reduction from the number that is somewhat pegged in the governor's budget, but there's a belief that given the revenue situation since the governor's budget was formed, that that was it was appropriate to work at 90% of that level. I also, I think, disclosed that we were looking at what would it cost as the first step of putting together the OHP 0305 budget or policy would be, what would it cost to do a federally mandatory minimum program, that is, mandatorily minimum populations and mandatorily minimum benefit design. And the price tag, the working price tag that came out of that from OMAP was about $837 million, which left about 96, and I'm talking in general funds now, and for the biennium, which left $96 million available to buy back additional
in this case
additional benefits.
Barney, the 836 was general fund and tobacco.
Correct. That's correct. It's more appropriate to say state funds, which would be a combination of general fund and tobacco. Thank you, Representative Cruz. So we looked at a package of four optional benefits, optional in the sense that they're not required by the federal government. But I think that the work group and the members of the legislative members probably all believe that they're really not optional, that they're an essential component to a decent benefit package. And those were prescription drugs, durable medical equipment, mental health services, and addiction or chemical dependency services. And the cost, the estimated cost, again, of state funds for all of those services was $259.4 million, which left a shortfall of $163.4 million that we had to find savings to be able to fund a mandatory minimum Medicaid program. The direction of the Chair Westland and Chair Cruz and Representative Bates and Chair Winters was to look. We met last Monday for 3 hours and last Wednesday night for 3 hours, looking at various ways within the projected estimated cost of how we could save $163.4 million, and if you will, buy those benefits back through various cost containment actions. Now I'll turn to the second handout, which says Oregon Health Plan Cost Containment Actions and Issues. And this document summarizes some of the main, all of the main concepts that were discussed in those two meetings, the first night being dedicated to prescription drugs and the second night dedicated to a more general discussion about trends and cost of living increases built into the budget and things like that. The italicized portions of the handout represent a summary, I think, created by Mr. Bacobian, that represent kind of a summary of where the group both the facts and some of the points around the proposals. And I'll just walk through these fairly quickly and then stop me if you have questions. We started first on the prescription drug benefit because it is a very expensive benefit to buy back. Net of behavioral offsets, it's about $200 million of state funds.
That's 200 of our 263 in our benefits buyback package. So that's by far and away not only the most important, I think, from an efficacy standpoint, but also the largest dollar amount.
And there were some very fundamental structural questions that were asked at the outset, both by some members of the stakeholder group and also by members of representatives from the administration, from DHS and OMAP. And that is, should we fundamentally look to a different approach for the state to buy prescription drugs? And you'll see the bullets. Some of these questions are highlighted in the bullets there, just the top of the center line of the first page. Should prescription drugs be capitated or on a fee-for-service basis? Should a non-state entity manage fee-for-service prescription drug costs? Should the state use an aggressive preferred drug list with prior authorization? Should the state maximize supplemental rebate opportunities? Should the prescription drug reimbursement be lowered? And what level of reimbursement is necessary to maintain delivery system access? And one of the first concepts that we spent a great deal of time on because of the potential savings is point one on page one, and that is to carve all of the prescription drugs out of capitation and have the fully capitated health plans continue to manage those drugs and be paid a management or an administrative fee for those, but in essence allowing the state to capture all of the state
rebates,
thank you. All of the state rebates. Right now the state gets rebates pursuant to federal Medicaid law for the fee-for-service populations, but it does not get rebates. The fully capitated health plans get rebates. They're not as large in most cases as the state would get, and therefore, if you will, the state could save money by increasing the rebates. Now, the downside to this model, and there was a lot of discussion about this, is that rebates save the state money only so long as the prescription drug benefit is managed in a, if you will, rational and conservative manner, like the FCHPs have been doing. The FCHPs are at financial risk for managing the prescription drug benefit, and they use their own preferred drug lists or formularies and other techniques within their delivery networks to, if you will, optimize the purchase or the use of prescription drugs. If the state were to do this simply on a fee-for-service basis with whatever management approach the state could bring to it, I think there's real concern that kind of the net savings might in fact be negative. So there was a lot of time spent talking about how the state could work with the FCHPs and in essence remove prescription drugs from the cap rate, maximizing rebates, but maintaining a responsibility at the FCHP level and what I call an administrative services only fee for administering them in their service areas. As you can see, the estimated savings right at the end of the paragraph one there is about $19.4 million. And so this concept is one of the largest cost savings in prescription drugs that we discussed. And I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, if you like, and if people have questions about this.
Any questions, Representative Merkley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your final line under that discussion is that for, without including the drugs in the capitation, the FCHPs may decide not to remain in the OHP. That certainly is a huge issue. Could you expand on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Merkley, historically, it's been known that the capitation rate for prescription drugs is perhaps a little larger than it need to be from the state's perspective, but that the what has happened in the way the FCHPs have managed prescription drugs and the other benefits that they manage under the state contract is that the savings that have been gained in prescription drug management have generally been used to offset or subsidize or enhance costs or reimbursement in other areas, for example, physician services. The caveat that was given in discussing this one single point was that the projected rates for 0305 have been rebased and rebalanced, if you will, using more current historical data, so that the hopefully the capitation rates for example, physician services more adequately address the actual cost of those services, and so at least the level of subsidy, cross-subsidization that might be lost would have a different, hopefully have a different impact. In the absence of that, there was real concern, though, that the FCHPs might not be able to, what I call, make the market, be able to get contracts signed.
Although, to flesh that out a little bit, and maybe Mr. Hetherington can nod up or down or back and forth, in conversations with the representative from the fully capped plans that was at the table, and in addition to several conversations I've had on a private basis with directors of plans, they seem to think that this portion of it can work if we combine it with a bulk purchasing where we could get some reduction of actual drug costs to the fully capped. Is that a fair assessment? I'm seeing Jeff go yes. And is that a fair assessment, Barney, of what
yes,
you think we've got to?
Mr. Chairman, I think that this point one can be looked at from the point of view of just the state purchasing drugs in a manner that it purchases them now for fee-for-service populations, except expanding the base, if you will, the size of the populations for whom the drugs are purchased. I believe when Chair Westland refers to bulk purchasing, there's also been discussed other avenues of where states can work in combination with other states, and if you will, even enhance the leveraging power of the state purchase beyond the, let's say, roughly 500,000 lives in our state Medicaid program. If we were to combine and do multi-state bulk purchasing, there would be some additional savings that would near to the state, and therefore making the if you will, the drug dollar go farther. So I believe that in summary, and again, I'm speaking as a facilitator, and all of these, I'm neither advocating one way or the other. I believe that this one held out lots of promise. I believe the FCHPs and others felt that there was a way, particularly if other parts of the 0305 rates were adequately addressed, that this is doable, that it, right. that it could be implemented, and there seemed to be some fairly broad support for it, or to at least look more in detail to see how it would work.
Yeah, and I think part of the concept behind this and this rate working is the fact that we try to, in the whole reimbursement matrix, make sure that shifts don't have to happen, that the reimbursements are what's put into the plan is true, and the dollars going to the various parts do indeed go to the various parts, so that the FCHPs aren't having to do all this shifting to cover one thing with something else. So it's going to be a more direct approach, theoretically.
And let me just remind the committee and those in attendance that as we go forward here, I mean, this committee, for the next week at least, is going to be working inside the same financial box that the work group was working in, and that this isn't going to be some of the revolutionary big picture stuff. We start that Monday a week from today. But we are charged with getting a report to Ways and Means that lives within our means and within a given number, which I think the work group very correctly identified as 10% less, at least 10% less general fund than what the governor had recommended in his budget. So, you know, as we go forward, please keep that constraint in mind. Go ahead, sir.
The second cost containment concept that was discussed is point two on page two of your handout, and net additional savings using enhanced prior authorization for prescription drugs, estimated savings $2.7 million state funds. let me stop here. Just these various concepts are, do not necessarily all fit together. They presume different kind of operating environments. This second one doesn't necessarily fit with the first one, but what it basically addresses that in the current fee-for-service prescription drug program, the state has developed what is called a PDL or preferred drug list as a result of legislation in last session, and there is a concept that would actually expand the use of that and requiring prior authorization for a physician to, if you will, prescribe outside the PDL where there is a drug on that list, and so OMAP estimates savings to be at $2.7 million. I'll stop there and just keep moving on if you'd like. This concept is not without some controversy.
And if we're able to implement the first discussion point, and I want to emphasize these are not recommendations, these are all discussion points, and this is a, you know, functionally a reiteration of discussions that went on in the committee, and this mirrors and fleshes out to, I think, a great degree the list of 33 points that we had previously handed out. Now, this fleshes out most of those points, those that gained some level of credibility or purchase within the committee. And obviously, if we're able to implement item number one, item number two becomes not relevant.
Well, it becomes more not relevant if we implement item number four. Right. So,
well, but we're going to get there.
The fact is that one and four make two unnecessary and, well, irrelevant is a good word. So,
point three relates to what's known as supplemental drug rebates, and this is a concept where under federal Medicaid law, states pharmaceutical companies have certain obligations regarding rebating to state Medicaid programs. And there are a number of states that are working with contracting with the pharmaceutical industries to develop preferred drug lists and other approaches that, if you will, move market, and that the state therefore then gets additional supplemental rebates for both brand and generic where the utilization of those drugs increases. And this point was talked about specifically in the context of a multi-state purchasing model that First Health Services, which is the state's pharmacy benefit manager, is working on with other states. And you can see that the estimated savings from the supplemental drug rebates somewhere between $1.7 and $2.5 million in savings. Again, I would characterize this that if concept one becomes, for example, a preferred strategy, then concept three becomes somewhat redundant. But again, you have to look at each of these somewhat independently, and some of these we could put together in pieces and others are more structural and strategic. The fourth one, which has already been referenced, would be to let the FCHPs through some contracting model manage the fee-for-service drug benefit in the service areas in which the FCHPs operate. Under this model, the state would continue to purchase drugs as it does now under fee-for-service, and I emphasize this is speaking to non-mental health drugs, but the fully capitated health plans would, for example, use their own formulary and use other drug review utilization techniques to enhance and hopefully economize on the expenditures in the fee-for-service drug arena. One point to demonstrate this, that there is a higher use of generics in the FCHPs than in the fee-for-service. The data that the stakeholder group looked at is somewhat dated, and while there's not a dramatic difference, we heard some evidence that the FCHPs have actually increased the use of generics, and that there's a significant savings. A 1% increase in the use of generics, for example, is about a $3 million biennial savings for the state. So there was great interest in discussing how the various FCHPs could, in fact, take on this responsibility, probably get paid again on an ASO basis, but be able to bring their management techniques for savings.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I'd say a caveat in all of this was if we're going to ask the FCHPs to manage RX, we were going to ask them to manage other aspects for the fee-for-service also. So it would be basically, I guess you could say, capitating fee-for-service in a way, but maybe not strictly in that model. And one of the comforts in going to something like this for RX rather than a state formulary is the fact that it still keeps us in the model where the providers are in control of their own formulary, and so they have the flexibility, and docs can have better chance to prescribe what they want rather than setting something up that's third party. So,
and 2 points about all of the fully capped formularies. I mean, if you lay them one on top of another, I mean, they're 98% the same. And it's not like we'd have, you know, 14 wildly different formularies out there. So, I mean, and these are formularies and methodologies developed over time that has proven effective in organizations that are not only concerned about the medical efficacy for their patients, but also being able to continue to provide the service. So yeah, I think there's a great deal of wisdom in this approach. I think the group, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ellen, but I think the group generally supported this concept, particularly, pharma, as long as there was additional management responsibilities, i.e. Yeah. hospital days, physician management brought into bear on the fee-for-service population. Is that a fair characterization, do you think?
Yeah. The one outlier on this, it would be the parts of the state that don't have capitated plans. There's some isolated things, Curry County, places like that, but then the most dramatic one being Jackson County, that's pure fee-for-service, and we're still struggling with how we treat those places. The sense was that with this, if we do this model, some plans may pick up maybe some of the smaller counties as part of their book of business, but then that still leaves Jackson County. So we'll let Dr. Bates.
That's Dr. Bates' problem. We're not going to deal with it. He can solve it. Well, I mean, but seriously, you can't get to that through an ASO agreement, various other types.
I mean, whether we go to a PCO there model or something like that is still on the table at this point.
I would reiterate that under under point four, what was said earlier, because we had some, I thought, very good discussion about looking at how the FCHPs could partner with the state in, for example, assisting in utilization management of hospitals as far as admission and discharge planning, of using some of the techniques they use in their at-risk population, of actually applying those in the communities on fee-for-service, and similarly for durable medical equipment. And again, it's bringing, if you will, the standards of care and the management techniques that are used in communities for one population and making them broader for all populations. And so that's an interesting model for to consider. Point five addresses...
Representative Greenlick.
No estimates on cost in point four.
No. Some of these are... The agency is still working on some of these, and in some cases, I think the model of the management relationship has to have a little more definition to it.
And on that very good point, Mr. Bacovian has asked DHS to tune into today's committee hearing. So as you know, we formulate questions, and they are continuing. Here's a real point: they are continuing to cost some of these models in estimated savings. So we should have some of this data pretty quickly.
Should we, Ms. Chair, should we say hi to Lynn at this point? Or?
Yeah. And, you know, we should say hi to Lynn, and we should thank Lynn and Gene Thorne and all of the DHS staff that was at these nightly work groups. I mean, they really went the extra mile. So wherever you are, Lynn, hi and thank you.
Mr. Chair, is there a sense this is a big item or a modest item?
I think it's a fairly big item. If you combine one and four.
Yeah. It,
oh, but I heard Chair Cruz say four makes one irrelevant.
No. Four made two irrelevant.
Yeah.
Because if we're still allowing the plans to operate their drug formulary, we don't need to have prior authorization, because the management is still at the plan level. So.
And in that regard, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think the conceptual combination of one and four becomes probably the most powerful model for kind of retaining the FCHPs and actually broadening their accountability and role in local management.
And to a degree, some of the softness in the numbers we'll get at this time, if we get into a multi-state compact, is how big that compact is and how big the real numbers are as far as the rebates we can get. You know, the more, well, because the more lives you have involved, the higher the rebate, and we don't know at this point how many states that model is going to look like.
Mr. Chair, may I ask another question? Barney, you've had experience with both Blue Cross Blue Shield and with Kaiser as organizations, and I always wonder how much of the kind of savings that we look at in both one and four are related to the development of a sort of organizational culture that defines a normative pattern versus the application of kind of external management techniques, utilization management review, a variety of things. I wonder if you might comment on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I think that to put your question in the context of the group discussion and my observation of that discussion, I think the interest in the fee and using the fully capitated health plans as a vehicle for enhancing the management of the fee-for-service population is in fact a function of what you just described, in that most of the fully capitated health plans have developed over time very strong working relationships with the local medical community. They oftentimes are the local, they're creatures of the local medical community, IPAs, et cetera. And so rules and approaches and standards of care that, if you will, are, quote, enforced by an organization that a physician or caregiver knows versus a more distant one that one doesn't know seem to work better. And there's usually quicker ways to get exceptions, and also if there's probably a problem with the policy, quicker, more expeditious ways to change the policy. And so I think that that's one of the things that we're trying to tap into in those communities that have FCHPs, particularly community-based FCHPs, and in the context of Kaiser Permanente with a prepaid group model, you get the medical support necessary to make these techniques, I think, much more effective.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Point five really relates to the third major area of the state's involvement in the in purchasing prescription drugs. We've talked so far about the prescription drugs that the fully capitated health plans purchase through their through the capitation arrangements that under contract with the state. The state purchases drugs for physical health for the fee-for-service cap for the fee-for-service population, and then the state also purchases drugs that are used primarily in mental health arena, and mental health drugs are solely paid for on a fee-for-service basis. And there's been some time is spent both in this committee and I would say some time in the mental health committee of talking about how can we the state get better value in the mental health drug purchasing arrangement. And point five basically throws out a concept of, is there a way that the fully capitated health plans and the mental health organizations can manage the mental health drugs so that we get the same or better effectiveness on the ground, if you will, but also try to save money. Again, this notes that the estimated savings are unknown. There is some calculating that's going on. I think there's some interest on the part of select FCHPs and mental health organizations to come together, perhaps in some demonstration projects, because right now a lot of the mental health drugs are written by non-mental health providers who are in the FCHPs. And so we have this strange betwixt and between going on, and this would begin to say we need to address that through some new management approach. I would then point that the items under six all have kind of, I think, one central theme, and that is how do we increase the use of generics where it's medically appropriate to use generics. There are significant savings in generics, and as I said, the estimate that was given to the stakeholder group that for every 1% increase in the use of generics, the state would save about $3 million per biennium. Again, just to reiterate that many of these are looking at it from the point of view of the fee-for-service drug benefit by itself. In the models of Model 1 and Model 4, where the fully capitated health plans play a more expansive role, many of the goals of the generic discussions would, in fact, be combined into those models. And I'll stop there, Mr. Chair. That's an overview of the major points in prescription drugs.
Barney, do we get later on into the whole concept of the mental health carve-out, or do we need to address it here?
I have to look ahead here. I'm not certain if it's...
Is that here?
No, we got that off.
Well, I mean, just from the perspective, I mean, mental health is a different universe, but when we're looking at the fact that a good very high percentage of mental health drugs are currently delivered by FCHPs, and the fact that it may be appropriate that it be there because, you know, mild depressions and things like that, and in talking to doctors, they say that those who are more severe are easily identified, and it would be our intention to make sure that we have the linkage so that they immediately go into the mental health system and mental health becomes the prime driver of their entire health care at that point in time. Ultimately, we may have some demonstrations where where we're at the local level, the two are being combined where it's appropriate. But other than that, it's going to be very important that the connectivity between physical health and mental health be well established and well defined, so that those that do have the severity that requires more intensive services can get to where they need to be. But with the assumption that on the front end, those who are of a more mild nature can get appropriate services in the FCHPs.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Well, and let's stress that Representative Cruz is talking about people with severe and chronic
right.
persistent mental illness. I mean, that 5 to 7% of the population. So to try and say that in fewer words, doesn't it make sense that their health care delivery system comes through the MHOs as opposed
right.
to the standard health plan caps? I think the answer is yes, and that actual point is addressed in the delivery section.
Okay, that's
you know, on first bullet point
Mr.
on page
Chair.
6.
Okay. Well, then I'm ahead of myself. Ahead of my time. Amazing.
No, you're just... Okay, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. It does deal with drugs, okay?
Right.
But it's more in the delivery system.
It is. It is. That's
which is what we got to on the second night. So we arbitrarily decided to put it into the delivery system.
Oh, okay.
Carry on, Gracie.
The burdens, you know, I have to bear.
I would conclude on the prescription drug section by merely saying that I think that my personal opinion was that there's a feeling in the room that when you total some of these up and you look at some of the potential savings, that it's probably not out of the realm of reality to be able to save in the magnitude of about $30 million through various... through carve-outs, increased rebates, and if you will, tougher management of the fee-for-service drug system. So that was Monday night.
One of the largest managers of a contractor in the state is in this very audience, and he's saying it's much higher than that. Right, Jeff? Okay, so we're in the $30 million range.
Mr. Chair, I always try to be conservative on that.
We're hoping. Fingers crossed. We don't have the numbers back yet. Please continue, sir.
Then on Wednesday night, we turn to a discussion of kind of the...
Barney, let me stop you there and just ask the committee as they... rapidly dwindle in numbers. If there's any questions at this point in time about, you know, kind of the direction I think we're going with regard to prescription drugs, any concerns, any accolades, any criticism, any additional comments?
Well, I was kind of, I mean, it seems to me you've gone exactly to the obvious places where we can make a difference. No, it's.
I mean, we'll have time to cuss and discuss this, you know, at length. But I mean, just okay. I mean, you hear this coming from, you know, our Barney the facilitator, who, by the way, did an exceptional job, and I think all those in attendance would concur with that in keeping us on track and on task. But this is where we got to. And so I just wonder if there's any initial reactions from the committee. Jeff, do you have any?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Only that these additional considerations under number 6
mm-hmm.
Seem to merit additional exploration and numbers to go with them. And other than
and
that,
we are going to get ample opportunity to do that.
Yeah, that really did raise a question with me, and I see Tom's in the audience. Under the 17% or whatever it is minus AWP, does a retail pharmacist, are they disadvantaged by having a generic versus a brand prescription? I mean, are they better off because I guess the key
their
is
fixed
they
costs
like
are
to
still the
lower
same
than AWP
right
on generic than buy a lot lower than AWP, and if you switch from a $30 prescription, from a $50 prescription to a $30 prescription, does that end up as a net loss because the dispensing fee is a relatively small part of that?
Well, I think at AWP minus 17, it's a net loss under any circumstance, but let's not argue that for the time being. Tom, could you indicate either up or down or sideways with your head? If you're selling a generic versus a branded name, you know, are you more likely to lose money at AWP minus? If you're going to give that kind of an answer, come up and identify yourself and answer Representative Greenleaf's question. Tom was another member of the work group that was there every night.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Tom Holt, the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. Chair Weston, Representative Greenlick, in answer to your question, I fudged and said it depends because the AWP rate is a ceiling on reimbursement for prescription drugs in the Medicaid program. There is also what's referred to as a MAC or a maximum allowable cost list that covers the more commonly used generic drugs. And that's a different system entirely. It's another priceless system, and what it does essentially is cuts the reimbursement further on those drugs. However, as a general rule, the pharmacy is better off on the generic drugs than on the brands. At where we are now in terms of reimbursements, it's pretty fair to say that most of the time, the pharmacy incurs a loss when they fill a brand name prescription in the Medicaid program. And on the generic products, there is a little bit of margin there, and because they are low cost, relatively speaking, you're better off there. So, you know, to use that example of, you know, go from a $50 brand to a $30 generic, is the pharmacy going to be better off or worse off? Probably not going to be worse off. Will they be better off? It'll depend on whether or not the product has a MAC.
I was looking at the juxtaposition between the first bullet here and the fourth bullet, where the extent to which a pharmacist is paid mostly on dispensing fee is the extent to which then the retail pharmacist becomes indifferent as to whether it's a generic or a brand, and therefore probably more willing to push towards generic, although maybe not based on your answer.
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, some states have done enhanced reimbursements for generic products in order to incentivize the pharmacies to, you know, take the actions necessary to switch someone. That would be one challenging dispenses written when there is an AB rated as an identical product available prescription, or to move someone to a last generation generic versus a current brand name prescription where you would need to get the physician's permission to make the change.
So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that if we can get to the place where we're tending to go here and we can increase the percentage of generics sold, you would not, it's fair to say, regardless of AWP minus whatever number, I'm not going to debate that, you would not be disadvantaged.
Chair Westland, I think if we were to increase generic utilization, it would both help the state meet its budget objectives and put our frontline practitioners' incentives in line with what you're trying to achieve in the budget.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hold on, just in case.
Question.
Representative Anderson.
You're saying that it's better for the pharmacist, or that by using generics they lose less?
Chair Westland, Representative Anderson, it depends. Most of the time, the pharmacy is going to be better off.
Losing less is better.
Another question, a little different tack. Are we talking about dispensing fee replacing the AWP minus 17, or both would be in action?
Chair Westland, Representative Anderson, I think we need to look at both of those. In terms of incentives to pharmacies or generics, you would want to look more at the dispensing fee because the AWP rate doesn't affect the generics as much as dispensing fees do.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. We still got time. Any other pharmaceutical question?
Chair Wessel, with your permission, could I clarify a point about the, of course, the list in terms of where the overlaps are? In your first options of number 1, 2, and 3,
right.
If you do number 1, the capitated health plans would continue to manage the drug benefit for their patients. It would not affect the fee-for-service population as it now stands under current statute and rules. So number 1 does not really overlap options 2 and 3. Those are priced at an assumption of our current fee-for-service population. That's just a clarifying point.
And that's exactly correct. I mean, and that's why I think that the general consensus, and we need to talk about this at length, is a combination of 1 and 4. And that's where I think the most equity is, the most savings, and the most manageable program. But I appreciate that clarification.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan. By the way, we have another work group member who, Ellen, if at any time you want to come up and add anything, don't hesitate to raise your hand, and I'd be more than happy to acknowledge.
In lieu of throwing something and hitting me in the back of the head.
Yeah, those are things she got at the last Ozzy Osbourne concert. You got to see her at these things. I mean, she just goes crazy.
Yeah, right.
Delivery system.
On page 4, Mr. Chairman, and then on Wednesday night, we spent 3 hours talking about kind of the large structural and financial issues around the 0305 budget regarding the FCH fees. You can see there that there was some, we continue to, I think, keep an open mind regarding the number of models that may be appropriate in today's environment, but we primarily looked at issues of reimbursement and also the benefit design. I want to start with number 7, since it's really not a delivery system in the sense of provider reimbursement, but it is a significant strategic concept, and it would be to take the prioritized list, assuming that the line is drawn at 519, condition treatment pair 519, and with federal approval, if we could overlay the prioritized list onto the mandatory minimum benefit package, there would be, it is estimated, a $57.8 million savings in state funds. And what this is in essence the savings of the below the line, the costs of the below the line procedures and services that without the list would be paid for under a mandatory minimum program. In addition, the some movement of the line, I think about by about 10. So this is a significant significant concept.
Barney, as I remember, somewhere there was a sort of minimum line drawn at some point, a sort of basic acceptable line. Is that above or below 519? Remember?
I do not remember, Mr. Greenlink.
It's my understanding, I think I'm answering your question. There was general consensus around the group that this was about as high as you could move the line, and that this was where we got, you know, anything above this, not only started getting into resistance with benefits, medical efficacy, but with CMS.
CMS will come sooner than that.
Yeah.
Well.
I think this is a 30.
The movement of the line that's assumed here is a movement that, because the Health Services Commission has done some work in what I would call the lower quartile of the list of rearranging condition treatment pairs, that there's a feeling, based upon physicians that have looked at it, that it's not the same there's not the same set of controversial types of treatments that if we move the line. And as I recall, the savings is $57.8 million is really about 6.5%, represents 6.5% of just the savings that comes by putting the prioritized list over that mandatory minimum benefit and having, if you will, a line below which certain things are not covered, and then about a little less than 2% because of moving that line this biennium, this forthcoming biennium compared to the last biennium.
Ellen, could you come forward? I mean, you're the representative from the Health Services Commission, and could you talk a little bit about this? This is not the same old list your grandmother had type of thing, and it has been reconfigured.
It was my grandfather.
Yeah, and so they've rejiggered it. There are no treatable cancers in here or that sort of thing. And then just for Nan, I mean, she has that confused look on her face like she normally does. All we're doing here is taking the federal Medicaid minimum benefits and laying the line on top of it.
The existing one.
The existing line. Okay. You with us now?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She only gets that look when you're talking, sir.
Yeah. No, I mean, best pies I ever had. And I say it as a compliment. Ms. Lowe, could you explain?
Members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I did serve on this little work group, and I'm also a member of the Health Services Commission. And we really,
Ellen, can you get close to the mic?
We very deliberately, the last two times we have reviewed the list, looked at it very carefully in terms of conditions where there was effective treatment available. And so I think as we reviewed the list, as Barney said, that bottom quartile, I believe that what we have done may not be what everyone wants in a health plan, but I think it will meet the definition of a basic health package.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ellen, how does it work if we don't adopt this effort to get a waiver for line 519? Is there some other line further down that currently is the de facto position for the Medicaid treatment? Or is this list irrelevant under the initial option?
Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, the current line is a result of negotiations between what was passed by the legislature in terms of funding and then the executive department, DHS, OMAP, in negotiations with, and I'm trying to remember, was it HCFA the last time we looked at the line? But we do have some indication in preliminary discussions with CMS that what the range that we're looking at now would be looked at as acceptable.
What we're after here is a benefit package that is defensible as good medicine, and we think we're there. Now, we would have an option of just saying, of just absolutely throwing out the prioritized list altogether and just going to mandated services. The reason for keeping the list is that there are some things under mandated services that we can exclude with the list, such as things like Viagra that we don't think are necessarily essential to keep people alive, although it may be essential to keep some people happy, but that's a whole other issue.
Also depends on your definition of alive.
That's true, and we could have a whole long discussion about that. But
or happy.
Or, well, I said
let's
happy.
Let's talk about this for a while.
but we, you know, if you really boil it down, when you get down to line 519, what you have looks an awful lot like a commercial package, and we think that's ultimately defensible, and we think it's approvable. by CMS. And keep in mind that what we are attempting to do here is stretch the dollars as far as we can and cover as many people as we can within existing resources. So it's appropriate health care. It's not a Cadillac by any stretch of the imagination, but it can't be, not in this environment.
And let me address maybe another concept brought up by your very fundamental and very good question, Representative Merkley, and that is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ellen, but you know, originally the state went for the first waiver and said, hey, let us provide fewer benefits so we can expand eligibles, and that was originally granted. Now what we're looking at,
fewer services,
so we can expand eligibles. Now what we're looking at is, okay, let us overlay the list on top of your mandatory eligibles, cover them, but allow us to provide more services to that same population. It's almost the opposite side of the same coin. Either way, we're trying to get more, and in this case, primarily the pharmacy benefit, DME, mental health, and alcohol and drug benefits to that population.
Mr. Chair, make sure I'm clear here, we would not be saying we would like a waiver where we have the ability to move the line ourselves in exchange for this. We'd be proposing a specific line and saying, here's the package.
Right.
So we still wouldn't have kind of the original premise of the health plan of being able to adjust to compensate for increased costs, so on and so forth.
Never had it. I doubt we ever will. And this is a 30-line movement.
Well, and Ms. Chair, there's also the fact that I don't think we would ever have a problem with CMS if we wanted to increase benefits. I think that would be allowable at any point in time. What we are trying to determine is what the base can be and get approval for doing that. It's expandable at any point in time based on resources. The resources aren't there. This is what we can afford.
Mr. Chair, may I just interject that I think something else that is happening by the Health Services Commission could achieve some savings without reducing the quality of care, and that's the list really is a list of conditions and then treatments, and so you may by the next time you see the list, see that the treatments, some of them may be step therapies, there may be some other limiting of the treatments that are available. And so, and part of that is just looking at the list, as some of us have discovered, is that some of the treatments are no longer being used by 99% of the providers, and so perhaps there's a reason.
And some of them are more open-ended than probably is necessary also.
The classic example being physical therapy, where right now it's an unlimited benefit. You can go 120 times a year if you want. I mean, limiting that to some number. Probably not a lot of savings there, but I think it's an appropriate exercise to go through. So you're not only moving the line up,
horizontal,
you're bringing it in. I call it horizontal limiting.
And that is, in fact, point 8 on this paper.
I believe Representative... Don't leave us. I believe Representative March has a question.
Well, I want to frame it maybe slightly different. To me, it seems like a paradigm shift in that the original premise was that we would reduce services... offer optional services to more people, that we would have optional services to the Medicaid eligible, plus we would provide the same equal services to a broader population. Now what we're saying is we will reduce services and provide it to a reduced population, the eligibles only. So we've retreated quite a ways from the original premise of expanding beyond the Medicaid population.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westland, I'll start. I think this effort, as I've conceived it, and I think many of the participants, is that this is kind of an incremental work product. That is, the first question we answered in the affirmative was, we want to have a Medicaid program. Then what does a basic Medicaid program look like, and how much will that cost? And then there are other populations that aren't addressed in this document. And quite candidly, we concluded almost every meeting by remember CHIP, remember medically needy, remember OHP standard as kind of the next steps of this effort. But it was really to see what's the paradigm look like for the Medicaid mandatory minimum population, and then there are going to be subsequent steps after that that are at least going to have to be discussed. Whether they can be funded or not is going to be another issue. But I think you have seen the insight into how we're going based upon the fiscal realities.
Thank you. I just don't want to forget about those other steps. Right.
No, but while I don't argue with your characterization, I think it would be also another way to state it would be, no, we've retreated way back beyond the original concept of the health plan. We've come up with a baseline federal Medicaid minimum. Now we're trying to figure out not only how to increase those services, i.e. the four that we're discussing, but get to additional populations as well. So opposite side of the same coin.
Yeah.
Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, I just wanted to make two points in this as Barney's talking. And the one is that I think we need to remember the difference between benefits and services, and that originally we were talking about all benefits and limiting services within benefits. Now we're talking about limiting both benefits and services to a certain extent. But the other point that I wanted to make is that as long as we had fully capitated health plans, the purpose of the list was to provide a basis for calculating a capitation rate. It really wasn't necessarily about what was provided. I remember discussions once about whether you provided service to somebody in a hospital after they had been diagnosed as having viral pneumonia. And the answer was, you did what you did, but what you had was a limited capitation rate, and how that was distributed makes a difference. In the fee-for-service part of it, it isn't true. I mean, then it's you either pay for something or you don't pay for something. I think we're getting to the point here where we're talking not only about the capitation, the using this map to create a calculation that produces a capitation rate for the fully capitated health plans, but one that will probably drive behavior to a certain extent. And I think that's where we need to keep an eye out, that we really believe these pairs make sense. And I was comforted by your Ellen statement that what's going on below the line has been changed some, because it could really turn into making a difference, particularly in an IPA model, fully capitated health plan.
May I escape?
Unless anyone has any other questions.
Don't let her out.
We just feel better when we've got you close at hand. But
I would like to, on point seven, I would like to make one clarifying comment for Representative Merkley's benefit, because he asked a question that maybe I didn't fully answer. But of the $57.8 million estimated savings in point seven, I believe I'm correct in saying this, about three-quarters of that is attributable to just laying the current list over the proposed mandatory minimum, and about one-quarter of that savings would be from moving the line from its current position up about 30. So we would need federal approval for either. The first should be quite simple because they've already seen that list and they've approved it. It would be, as Representative March indicates, for a slightly different reason. We're not expanding populations in this. We're getting more benefits. And then moving the line would be, would be a different kind of effort, not impossible. I'm not trying to characterize it. But it would be a line movement, but also because of the work of the Health Services Commission, the nature of that line movement should be less medically controversial.
Right.
Yeah.
And politically controversial.
Right. Right.
Representative March.
When you say
hold on, Ellen, because, I mean, we're on line stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Barney, when you say more benefits, you don't necessarily mean more than we're getting now under Oregon Health Plan Plus.
No, I mean more than the mandatory
minimum. More than
minimum.
Mandatory, yeah. Correct.
Correct. More than the mandatory minimum.
Yeah.
Right. We're starting from zero sum here.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
From kind of baseline, it's what can we buy back from the mandatory minimum?
Okay. Yeah, and I don't know if this is just because the members of the work group has been exposed to this for so long. I mean, you know, we're through the denial. It's the way it is. We've got round numbers, $930 million. OHP2 is gone. I mean, we're starting from base bedrock, at least what we consider base bedrock. You can actually go back to a health system that doesn't include federal dollars and provide whatever the heck you want. We don't recommend that. I don't recommend that.
Yeah, I just didn't want anybody to think that we were actually offering more benefits than anybody was getting now.
No. And heavens no. But the bottom line is, you know, when we looked at the hole we had to fill here, to have what we consider to be a reasonable health plan, it was quite daunting in the beginning. And just filling that hole is hard enough proposition, let alone dealing with any expansion. So
I would just very briefly hit on point 8, which has already been referenced, and it's been referred to as the vertical line movement. And then if you think of the prioritized list as moving horizontally and eliminating complete condition treatment pairs, a lot of interest in looking at moving a line vertically in so that in some condition treatment pairs, there could actually be limits on the number of services or the quantity of services. And the best example would be for the state to follow, for example, what many commercial coverages have, which would be an annual limit on the number of physical therapy visits or the number of occupational therapy visits, or at least putting a limit with requiring additional prior authorization based upon medical necessity as opposed to leaving it just wide open. That's but one example. And there is some effort going on to try to calculate that, a savings around that. I would point to number 9, the estimate for buying back a total durable medical equipment benefit for the mandatory population is about $21 million state funds.
Barney, could I interrupt you? Ellen, thank you for your very articulate testimony. I mean, you are absolute living, breathing proof that outlaw rock and roll will not rot your brain.
Yeah, but what happened to you?
Well, that was
a
CD issue.
Well,
right there.
Okay, whatever.
Go ahead.
Should I proceed, Mr. Chair?
At your own risk.
Point 9, I'm trying to get through this as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I know you are.
Point 9 is on DME, and while we didn't spend a lot of time specifically on what I'd call tactical approaches, it is known that the FCHPs and the DME industry, the FCHPs already use various approaches to manage their DME benefit. The DME industry is looking at ways to develop recommendations for the legislature to have a DME benefit that's more cost effective. And so we're basically saying there's money to be saved in that benefit by either cutting some covered services or by tougher management. Item 10 is one of the, notice that it has $29.7 million savings. This is a concept that says if the reductions that have been put in place by OMAP for hospital reimbursements, if those reductions are put into the calculation for the 0305 cap rate and then increased by 10%, in essence, giving the FCHPs less money than the full roll-up costs of the biennium, but more money for hospital services than would be in a fee-for-service budget, there are savings that can be made, and yet the FCHPs would still be in a position, because it's 10% higher than the base, to be able to, if you will, negotiate with their local community hospitals. This is a concept that's not without controversy, because it basically moves us, 10 and 11 move us into this issue of how much will providers in fact be reimbursed or under-reimbursed relative to their costs. And I would lump 10 and 11 together, because what we talked about generally near the end of the Wednesday night meeting was there's about $80 million in the budget between fully loaded for trend and cost of living increases, projected pricing increases in both fee-for-service and fully capitated, and none. That is, having no trend in for utilization, no trend in for costs. Now, it's one thing to talk about not giving providers rate increases. That has consequences, and that was talked about. There can be foolhardy, I think, to say that you're not going to recognize trends in utilization in which intensity or admissions per thousand or whatever are going to happen, because even in the fee-for-service realm, if those trends happen and the budget doesn't have those trends in, ultimately there will be a rebalance plan before Ways and Means. But the issues that are encompassed in both 10 and 11 have to do with rates of increase of growth for the FCHP capitation rates and for the fee-for-service unit service rates. And I don't know how, Mr. Chairman, how you want to characterize, want me to characterize this concluding part regarding rates, other than I think that there was a general recognition that that the legislature would ultimately probably have to do what the legislature has to do. And I think there was a plea across most of the providers, as I recall it, that it should be somewhat equitable. And I'll leave it to that and let those others who were there.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I would say to a degree that we looked at the actuary report and had trouble reconciling that to reality just on its face, and then when you take a look at the other things that we're thinking about doing as far as controlling utilization and things like that, it made even less sense. And so I think at the end of the day, Barney is right that we inside of Oregon determine the amount of, once we have determined the amount of money that's available and kind of got a fair handle on distribution potentially, we look to the plans and the hospitals and the docs and everybody else involved and see if they can make a business out of it. And I don't think we necessarily need to go to an outfit that is basing their report on numbers that we don't have good data on, number one, and also number two, that are basing a lot of things on national trends that don't necessarily speak specifically to Oregon. So I think the direction we're going is trying to do this inside of Oregon and see if we can come up with a better model than what currently exists.
And I think to flesh that out a little bit, Representative Cruz is talking about PricewaterhouseCoopers, and they acknowledge that according to their model, we have been underpaying by significant percentages depending on what the category is. And so now some of their utilization and cost inflation numbers are catch-up numbers, you know, whatever the numbers are. I think what Representative Cruz is saying, and I and every member of the work group would concur with, is what's the number that keeps the delivery system intact and afloat? You know, recognizing these are difficult times, what can we do to bridge this gap? I think that's a fair characterization of where we were.
And I would just add that I think there's a realization, and it's under in the italic paragraph under 11, where it talks about lowering physician fees could lead to physicians no longer accepting OHP clients. I would just broadly state that lowering the fees either through the fee for service payment schedule or through FCHP rates, whether it's physicians or others, we don't know the stability of that network out there, and I think that's the balance that the legislature will be looking for. I think the encouraging sign that came out of Wednesday night meeting was a recognition that many of the provider groups will work with the legislature on that front. But there's still a market that has to be made right out there on the ground.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Well, hold on, Representative Green. Look, I see Representative Bates has joined us, so I guess we can go home now. Representative Greenlake.
There's an implicit assumption in 10, I guess, that we can arrange it so that the fully capitated health plans can get contracts with the hospitals at a DRG rate that we set. Is that an assumption, and if so, is it a realistic assumption?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, one of the questions that I posed of the Waterhouse Coopers, PwC representative was there, and the agency was that there is a state law that states that, in effect, that through the FCHPs, that the rate needs to be set at a point that reflects reasonable cost. There's no such statutory requirement in the ORS for Medicaid fee-for-service. And the question I pose that if a capitation rate is built with assumptions different than what an actuarial analysis would say, I'm just be hypothetical. You take the actuarial analysis says you should pay the hospital X and you're going to pay them 75% of X. Is that in fact permissible under current law? And there, one response that I remembered was that there may be a change in the law, or there may be a willingness on the part of providers to participate nonetheless. But you are correct that what 10 envisions is creating an artificial market and upping it by 10% and then having the FCHPs use that in their contract negotiations. It's not without either legal risk or what I would call market risk.
I mean that we, you can assume Care Oregon can get X rate in its negotiation with, say, St. Vincent Hospital, and you can assume that in what you're paying, but unless you put something in that requires that to happen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, I think the assumption here is that because it would be 10% higher than, say, the Medicaid fee-for-service rate, that hospitals being run by rational people, that they're better off with X plus 10% than with X. That may be true. I can envision a situation, though, where that doesn't necessarily play out that way because of real or perceived inequities.
I hate to be trapped in a rational model of the world, Bernie.
Well,
they might be willing to say, yeah, I'll take it for a small population, but I'm not willing to take it for a large population. And I mean, that's what always worries me. You can assume a can opener here, but unless you can really open a can with that can opener, you've just assumed all you have is... I think it's a great idea if we can carry it off.
Well, and I'd be much more concerned about the market risk than the legal risk.
Yes.
I mean, we can...
We can take care of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But right. Bottom line is, it's got to work. I mean, you have to be able to go out and make a market in this stuff. And so, again, I mean, the rational comment is you're getting X for the same population. How about if we give you, you know, X plus 10 and...
Or zero.
Yeah, or zero. Yeah, price of failure or zero. And I understand there can be some resistance to that logic. Yeah, we don't live in a, you know, the world isn't necessarily rational. It's not necessarily irrational. It's the way it is.
Mr. Chair,
well,
I like
deep.
I think what we're going to try to do here is just get through other considerations and go to the management actions.
Well, and I would very quickly just note that, I mean, there was some, the first bullet talks more about cutting fees but retaining some increase in reimbursement at fee-for-service fees, but for FCHPs. These are all variations on the theme of trying to find that fine balance of, if you will, keeping the networks viable and the providers participating in those, but also being able to live within the budget reality of 0305. Some discussion of, for example, the physician care organization, which would be a slightly different risk model than we have with the fully capitated health plans. The bullet on the next page that Representative Cruz and Representatives Cruz and Resslin talked about was actually perhaps redeploying some subpopulations into a different managed care model because they carry certain physical and mental health illnesses that really need aggressive management across the continuum. And then the second bullet...
Barney, if I could just slow you down there. I think that top bullet point on the top of page 6 is a significant concept that this committee wants to explore. I mean, that is a shift of taking the, you know, seriously and chronically medically ill out of the physical side and putting them more squarely into the mental health side, and that's where they would receive some of their physical health benefits. I think there could be some significant savings here on both sides of that equation.
They would still receive their physical health benefits where that was appropriate, but it was kind of like if the majority of their health care is over here, that's, you know, and the dollars follow the person, right. That's where the dollars would be, and then they would, rather than the other way around. So
the next bullet we've actually talked about under various points previously, and that is the FCHP managing other aspects of the fee-for-service client and service continuum. Brief discussion on block granting, and then, of course, the eliminating cost-based payments for type A and B or one or the other. I think the major concepts under the delivery system are the changes in the benefit because of the list, and then this whole issue that of balancing the trend reimbursement increases against budget reality and market realities. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to try to answer any other questions. And
thank you.
My responsibility as facilitator is now ended.
But your responsibility as an Oregonian continues. So.
As I was told by one of my previous bosses, many are cold, but few are frozen.
Well, I was kind of going to another place here. So we will appreciate your continued observance and participation and contribution to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been a pleasure.
Barney, the facilitator, thank you for your exceptional job, sir. Yeah, before he gets away, any questions? I think what we're going to do is stop here unless the committee wants to have any intercommittee discussion. We'll get someone from OMAP in here tomorrow to talk about management actions within the department that can save some dollars. But in terms of public policy, I think these are the major issues that the committee covered. Any comments, Representative Bates?
The one question I had when I read through these documents this morning, and I really appreciate you working on it over the weekend, and you've seen my comments already to you. The one area I was hoping to get some pricing on, I don't know if OMAP can do it for us, is within the idea of the package we're going to offer with the line being moved up is changed inside there as far as utilization is concerned. How often you get physical therapy? How often you go to mental health? Those things.
We've asked those questions. They're supposed to be pricing those dynamics now.
Make it look more like a
That's going to be harder for them to get their hands around to get numbers. But Dr. Goldberg is working on that now.
So make it look more like a commercial product.
Right.
The limits that commercial products have on them for very good reasons.
Right.
Representative Anderson.
Two questions. First. In terms of the block grants, and this is more discussion than question, I was approached by RIPA in Josephine County saying they'd love that. They'd love to be block granted and be responsible to make it on that amount. Is this proceeding forward?
Well, let's talk about it here. I mean, that's a big issue. It's on the table. It's like most of these ideas. I mean, there's good and bad, pros and cons.
And we would assign different levels of funding to each of the, for instance, Kaiser, I assume, would be one, Providence, and then all of the 14 IPAs. Each one would be designated the amount that they could spend for the biennium.
Well, Kaiser isn't going to participate too much, but...
They would be...
Although statutorily, we could handle that.
And we should.
Wait, we got to keep Barney alive for a couple more weeks here.
He just got frozen.
Yeah.
How does this fit together? That's what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, that's... Thank you. That's the $64 million question. That's
$164 million, but you're close.
Yeah, $64 million, $164 million question. That's what this committee is going to...
Okay. Second question was, where does control of the mental health fit in with an IPA? Because, again, locally I'm hearing we would like to manage the whole thing, not eligibility. We'd like to have control community or mental health under the county as it now, and it's fragmented. And the IPA is saying, we think we can manage it even better than it's being managed, and we're in a very good county.
Well, I guess that's local option sort of things. And as we talked about the mental health delivery system, in some places that sort of model might work very well. In other places it might not. And I don't think we want to, if the MHOs and the FCHP in a certain area could be combined for a wraparound delivery system, I don't think we're going to put anything in place that necessarily would stop that. But by the same token, I don't think we're going to require that sort of collaboration all places. It's, you know, the redesign of mental health delivery is kind of a different subject and how those tie together.
CHP is doing a great job,
mm-hmm.
and others aren't.
Mm-hmm.
While I'm not advocating for requiring, at some point we should be steering people to the most successful program, shouldn't we? Because it's going to save costs and add to the number of people that can be covered.
Well, we can, but to say that the system designed for Multnomah County and Josephine County would look anywhere similar, I think, is not realistic. So, I mean, the problem with us from the state level saying this is a good model, everybody go out and recreate it, it doesn't work just because of the different needs in different communities and the different structure they need to have. Every time we have tried to create a one-size-fits-all model, it has fallen apart just because of the local dynamics.
You go across the county line.
We'd be happy to send some people down.
You go across the county line, and, I mean, they have very few. I mean, they really don't. They have a shell of a managed care system. So you start talking about integrating mental health into that, which is, and I agree with you in concept. I mean, you've got physical health laid next to mental health, laid next to county mental health, laid next to county alcohol and drug. And there's some redundancy and administrative costs that I think we have a tough time justifying now. And we can discuss this. I mean, if there are management structures that have the capacity, and I think that's the key. I mean, three key words to life: management, management, management. If there are management structures that have the capacity, consider that, and they can glean savings from the combining of those two delivery systems, far be it from me or us to say I don't think you should do that. In fact, I agree. I think we should encourage that.
Yeah, could we turn it around a little further and say that if you do very well, there may be incentives for you in the next go-round so that you may actually get more, be able to cover more people in an efficient system, in a sense penalizing those counties or those areas that do not do well.
Of course, they want more.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking 05, 07?
I think we, yeah. Right, the next guy.
Mr. Chair.
It could be. I mean, Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure we're understanding what we're talking about here and what we're discussing, because I think it's very easy for us to get confused about this. You mentioned IPAs wanting to take over the entire mental health care program. Most IPAs are driven for physical health, and they do take care of depression and anxiety, but they are not dealing with people who have severe mental illness, and it's chronic and long-term, that are delusional, psychotic. And I'm not aware of any IPAs that want to take over that part of the population, and I may be wrong in what you're trying to tell me. Your local group, which I'm very familiar with, has an outstanding IPA as far as physical health concerned, and laying next to it an outstanding group that is taking care of mental health of the second group I mentioned, the persistently and severe mentally ill. That group, I believe, would probably like to expand their program and take some of the other dollars to do it with, and that would probably be a very good thing for them to do. But I think the IPA, just so we have our terms correct, probably, knowing them, is not interested in taking over that mental health group of the severe and persistent mentally ill. If I need to be correct in that, please do so. So I'm assuming that's the two groups you're talking about.
I think they do have an interest in managing, but not providing the mental health care to those who are most incapacitated mentally.
So I am hearing from you that you believe your IPA, the clinic and the other group, is interested in taking over the management of this other program?
I'm not sure about the clinic, but I think possibly if the one IPA got into it, the clinic would work with them to just overall manage. Not to, they might contract out to the NHL right now, the county's doing it. But I'll find out more information, and in fact, they would like to come and present, so we ought to schedule them.
Robin should have an opportunity for the other side to tell their story, too, at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, and the one thing that, and I don't want to get too deep in this right now, but there's one more piece of this, which, because if you're talking about mental health, you got to get CD in there too, and there's another delivery system for that, but that's got to be included to have the whole scope of things. And if you go to Southern Oregon, where you have many counties with well-functioning IPAs, and then one county that Alan can't seem to get his hands around. And then you lay over that, you've got Jefferson Behavioral, and then you've got subsets of that, and then you have CD delivery systems. There's one that has three counties and another that has a couple. So there's a lot of dynamics that come into play here, and I guess part of what I am ascertaining or advocating for is the fact that we shouldn't tell them how they combine things. So,
and again, one track, two rails. First track, do what we know we can do within the given budget. The second rail, we can definitely get into more creative approaches to system delivery as well as cost savings. Any other business coming before the committee?
The one to watch out for.
We are adjourned.
Watch out for that rail, boss.